Chapter 2. Prawn. It is the spring equinox, early in the morning. The tide has yet to pull down, and I am here to dig a rock pool. I am dressed for it, a thick hat, 3 padded shirts, thermal underlayers, neoprene waders, heavy-duty gloves, and a pair of roofer's knee pads. The air temperature is just above freezing, but the wind makes it colder. I have a chisel and a set of bolsters, a steel bucket, a geological hammer with a pick on one end, some steel bars and club hammers. Suitable for wrecking, dismantling and prying, the sales blurb had said. A mallet, a spade, a full-size pickaxe and a long simple steel spike with which to lever away the rocks in which the pool will rest. For 3 wet, cold days, leaving when the tide rose, returning when it fell, with my chisels and wrecking bars, I dug down into the early Jurassic rocks, seeing things that had not been seen for 200 million years, becoming as familiar with them as with the soil in my own garden. It was hard, slow and dirty, as sloppy as a Flanders trench, the process as graceless as the churning of a concrete mixer, until, finally, I was done. After one tide had washed it clean, the new pool looked serious, but lovely, grey and stony, but a place of calm, framed by its basalt lumps and Jurassic sandstones, a bright window away from the world of flux. All I had to do was to wait, impatiently, for something to happen. I read, I tidied the house, I filled a small aquarium with seawater for the moment I might find some creatures to put in it. I split some logs and did the laundry. Nothing happened. One tide brought in a piece of bladder wrack, but it was loose, a bit of flotsam, not integral to the life of the pool. The next tide floated it away again. The frenzy that had gripped me over the 3 preceding days, that muddy exhaustion, felt like an irrelevance, out of sync with the way things are. This nothing-doing was more like the nature of reality, steady, unbroken, the long-form music of the patient world. The cosmic and planetary rhythms were playing the music of the spheres, but their pattern is too long for any single life to recognize them. What do they translate into? Only the longue durée, the unbroken lastingness of repetitive being. The high and low tides moved on in their 50-minute progress through the days. The moon shrank and grew. The curlews cried their love weep, morning and evening. I read The Life of Virginia Woolf by Hermione Lee, in which she quoted Woolf's diary from the 8th of September 1918. I remember lying on the side of a hollow, waiting for Leonard to come and mushroom, and seeing a red hare loping up the side and thinking suddenly, this is Earth life. I seemed to see how earthy it all was, and I myself an evolved kind of hare, as if a moon visitor saw me. This is what this first pool was giving me, this long gaze at being. I sat on the bench in front of the house reading Professor Lee's book. The surface of the bay looked like slit silk, dark, but with slips and islets of brightness all the way across it, where the light was catching the incoming seas, and, thanks to Wolf and her biographer, life seemed for a moment then to be what Wolf took it for, a pattern of eddies and back-turnings, an endlessly shifting density field in which identities and truths come and go. Wolf was entranced by liquidity, which could embody realities that solids could scarcely address. Water as a source of ecstasy, sheeting the body like an eel, pouring down the wall of the mind. In her hands, fluidity attaches to more than ordinary liquids. Existence itself can dissolve and soften so that it seems as if the whole world were flowing and curving, on the earth, the trees, in the sky, the clouds. The source of this entrancement lay deep in Wolf's memory, of the room in Talland House in St. Ives in Cornwall, where her family went on holidays when she was a girl, of which the memory, as she wrote, stood at the foot of her life, as the base of a bowl stands beneath it, holding out its open cup. The memory is of lying half asleep, half awake, in bed in the nursery at St. Ives. It is of hearing the waves breaking, one, two, one, two, and sending a splash of water over the beach, and then breaking, one, two, one, two, behind a yellow blind. It is of hearing the blind draw its little acorn across the floor as the wind blew the blind out. It is of lying and hearing this splash and seeing this light, and feeling it is almost impossible that I should be here, of feeling the purest ecstasy I can conceive. Then again from a draught of Jacob's room, written in 1920. The blind was thin yellow, curved out, for the nursery window was open. It curved fuller and then was sucked in. At the same time the sea made that dull noise. Then the water was drawn back. Then it made the dull noise again. Now the blind was filled with more yellow, and the dull noise sounded further away. The little trailing noise that the knob on the blind cord made as it was drawn across the floor made him open his eyes. Life is tidal, full of loss and arrival, a thing that makes and ebbs, of that wooden button dragging on the floor to and fro, full of things half present and half forgotten, in which the truth of experience goes beyond the material or biographical fact, a set of dissolving realizations that come more easily on a shore than in other places, perhaps because of the constant under-music of the waves and the coming and going of the tide. An evening came when the moon was full and the tide was down. The mud-sand of the bay was skinned in moonlight, which the surface of the pool concentrated in its own bright mirror. I went down with a torch and knelt beside it. There in front of me was all I needed. 5 common prawns, pool life, glimmer still, with points of white electric light, pure and pin-like, scattered over them. Sparkled lines of those chromatophores were dotted along their legs and bodies, marking the plates of their armour, in their foreclaws and up the long wavering radio mass of their antennae. Here were some cohabitants, life where there had been none, companions in the desert of the rocks. This was the first time things had lived on these rocks and sands in 200 million years. Common prawns, they were Palaemon elegans, named after one of Jason's argonauts by the German zoologist Martin Heinrich Rathke in 1837, may indeed be the commonest of creatures, and every child catches them at the seaside, but it felt like a sort of de-extinction. I had made a place where life was welcome. I knelt and watched them. Minuscule adventurers, at home in this world, with pitch-perfect neutral buoyancy, floating in their stillness neither up nor down. With the slightest movement of their swimmerettes, the paddle feet below the centre of the body, they send themselves from headland to headland across the micro-ocean I have made. Each scoots past the others as if they were aerial taxis, something like the fleet in Blade Runner, inhabitants of a liquid universe just deeper than their bodies. They are very nearly transparent, glass beings, and can look like the specks that float in the surface of your eyes, semi-seen presences, with no more than a hint of inner organs glimpsed beyond the grisaille of their armour. They drift towards the invisible. If the sun is shining, they are spotted most easily, not directly, but through the shadows they cast on the floor of the pool, like the images of aeroplanes projected far below, sliding seamlessly over rock and leaf and sand. It is the exoskeleton that defines them. They are toy-like because that is usually how our toys are built, hard on the outside, even metallic, with the workings protected. But these are toys that Fabergé would have made, enamel brooches that scud beneath me, the dark eyes on each side of the head on stubby little stalks, independently, constantly, and even feverishly alert and looking, the little forelimbs, the maxillipeds, endlessly gathering microscopic detritus from the rocks and pushing it into mouths on the underside of the head, the swimmerettes paddling, while the long walking limbs in front straddle across the pool floor, bracing the body, less architectural than engineered, struts for life. One of those limbs now and then reaches up and over the back of the carapace, cleaning and sifting there like a man scratching the baldness on his head. The prawns are just longer than the top joint of my thumb, but as intricate as a space station, a machine for processing life, a micro-engineer's fantasy of applied brilliance, as indifferent to sleekness as the most inner part of an engine or computer, all purpose, no appearance, articulated, tooled up, strange. The complexity is bewitching. I feel assailed by the absolute singularity of things. Hardly a natural historian, Stephen Jay Gould once wrote, has failed to locate his chief delight in the lovely puzzles of actual organisms in real places. These, for this morning, are my lovely puzzles, and I want to unravel them. And so first I see that they are like me. For all their strangeness, I can see my body in their symmetry. A trunk with its appendages, its orifices, its sensory mechanisms, its means of movement, of finding and consuming food, of perceiving and understanding the world, all arranged around the same one central axis. We are balanced like each other, but if lateral symmetry is in both of us, there is also a longitudinal asymmetry in both of us. Our fronts differ from our backs. Like me, the prawn is arranged in a hierarchy of engagement, with sensing first. I have forward-reaching eyes and ears and nose. He has those whisker antennae, the finest of fly-casting rods, amazingly equipped with smelling and tasting and desiring organs at their tips, which put the prawn's self far out in front of its body, so that the animal does not wander into closeness with another, but will always approach carefully, sensitively, and perhaps anxiously. Behind that delicacy of arrival comes the limbs with different functions, mandicatory for chewing, ambulatory for walking, natatory for swimming, and finally, within the hinged plates of its glamour armour, the thrusting escape mechanism, the big muscle which in crisis the prawn, like many other crustaceans, can rapidly contract to give itself a fast backward and or upward thrust, using the big flattened fins on the tail, accelerating away from threat. There, it is true, we differ. It is difficult for a human being to leave a room in quite such a hurry as a prawn, but in both of us, this combination in the body of lateral symmetry and longitudinal asymmetry is the formative architecture of ourselves, vertebrate and invertebrate as we are, with something like 700 million years of evolutionary difference between us. Our bodies construct our worlds. The prawn and I live in the different universes that our physical beings create for us. But what we share is this: knowing there is a difference between us and not us. We are not what surrounds us. We are not the world in which we live. The presence of ourselves is the most enormous thing we know. The irony of the prawn's life is that the very thing that is designed for its safety, the giant escape muscle, triggered by the prawn's startle reflex, is the reason 7 million tons of them are eaten by us every year. That tail is the meat in every prawn sandwich. I think of the thousands of these animals I have eaten, those meaningless bits of sweet meat, the stupidity of my encounter with them, a mild maritime delicacy, salted and peppered. How blunt I am compared with what they are. This drift and skitter in front of me now, the courage of their lives, that quiver-touch sensitivity of the little being with all its purposefulness and manoeuvrability and fineness, set against my motorway lunch, the mayonnaise slather between the butter and the bread, the Brobdingnagian meanness of me dumped over the precision beside which I am now kneeling. Not that I am unique. The English language flicks carelessly between the names it gives to shrimp and prawn, without attention to anything they actually are. Gaelic is worse. These animals can be identified either as Caran or Caran Cricha, meaning sea eel, conger eel, shrimp, prawn or stickleback, or Clawyak, meaning any small fish found under seaweed, the prawn, shrimp, small lamprey. The language tells you what you had already guessed. We scarcely care to know about the reality of these intricate lives. Prawns live in a world of threat of which we are a part. As I watch, a shore crab, a lovely Bentley green, mottled with black spots on its back, darkening towards the eyes, cratered with those spots like a map of its own planet, suddenly manoeuvres on the floor of the pool, a single multi-leg step out from the shadows, and then tucking itself back in under the lean-to roof of some basalt. In the scale shift of being with the prawns, the crab looks large and threatening. The prawn's cool liquid swimming turns suddenly to a frenzied jackknifing, each of them tail flipping back and away from the crab, the power flex thrusting them into clear water. One prawn flings itself by mistake into a dark place from which it thrashes back out again, perhaps another crab in there, making for the shadows under a flake of limestone, a refuge into which it shoots its body, disappearing like Mephistopheles in a burst of fear. Is it too much to think that the prawns have panicked at the appearance of the crab? Melanie Challenger, the English philosopher of animal life, has compared her own panic attacks to these startled responses in other creatures. She was on a walk one winter's day. I felt happy enough, but in less than a moment, a shade cut across. My heart began to beat like crazy, and my palms began to sweat. It was as if the uncontrollable elements of the outside world had passed into me and obliterated my sense of self. This kind of sudden terror is an animal shadow sweeping over the human form. While the brain's language centres work at any narrative that might assist, other regions of the body bang out norepinephrine and serotonin to prepare for an imaginary threat. Legs become twitchy and ready to run like hell. These are the signals from what Challenger calls the mysterious and disconcerting regions of selfhood, where the terror, as she says, of being physical, of being trapped inside something that will die, overwhelms the steadier metronomic patterns and habits of life. The prawn's startle reflex is not far from that human experience of the spectre of death. Much of its life is predicated on fear. Its many tools are designed both to accommodate and to avoid it. The body is both armoured and half-visible, coated with the dazzle markings that make its outline uncertain. Between its eyes, its carapace stiffens into a yet harder serrated rostrum, which is surprisingly stiff and acts like the nosepiece on a Greek or medieval helmet, defence against the hammer blow or sword cut. And the animal can run from trouble. How much nearer that is to us and to the commotion of human existence, with its tides of love and fear, and all the dysfunctional transmutations of that fear into paranoia, hypochondria, obsession and anxiety, than to the rocks and sands among which it lives. We and the prawns are cousins, however distant, in a way basalt or granite can never be. These little creature puzzles look delicate, and in some ways they are. They are up here in the pool, not far from the top of the beach, because they like it here and choose it, tucked away from the turbulence of the sea. They are not as good at standing up to waves as their slightly more robust cousins, Palaemon serratus, which live in the deeper waters and as a result form a larger proportion of the commercial prawn catch. And so Palaemon elegans and Palaemon serratus divide the sea between them. It may be the stronger and bigger serratus outcompetes elegans in deeper waters, but how does the elegant one find the ideal niche for its existence? It has recently been discovered that these inshore prawns smell their way towards the best places. When some rock pool prawns from New Zealand, close relations of elegans, were put in experimental tanks and given a choice of swimming up a channel filled with water taken from pools in which there was no seaweed, or a neighbouring channel flowing with water taken from weed-filled pools, they consistently chose the weedy water, reading the chemical signals given off by the racks, telling the prawns that there was a place of greater safety. Weed both hides them from predators and provides shade in which they can stay a little cooler than in the warm and salty water of a rock pool exposed to the sun between the tides. It may have been the odd piece of detached bladder wrack washed in by the tide that drew them in here the other night. Nevertheless, life in a rock pool is tough. Temperatures can slew from freezing to 30 degrees Celsius or more. I have often, at the end of a summer afternoon, put my hand into a shallow pool late on a rising tide, just before the sea reaches it, and found the water as warm as in a tepid bath. For as long as the tide stays down, the pool water continues to evaporate, salinity climbs, and its oxygen content falls. Palaemon serratus does not do well in these conditions, soon dying, but Palaemon elegans can cope with those daily tidal shifts, lasting up to 4 hours in water with no oxygen at all. A single hour does for Palaemon serratus. And returning to normal much more quickly when the newly oxygenating tide water comes in. Not that the experience is without stress. Lactic acid, felt by us as the burning in the muscles when running or rowing, also builds up in the prawns' muscles and blood when exposed to these low-oxygen waters. That can be imagined. The tide drops, the pool starts to warm up, the prawn begins to feel the stress of an environment in which it is increasingly difficult to breathe. The water around it becomes the equivalent of thin air. More water needs to be breathed through the gills than when it is cool and oxygenated. Life has turned hostile. And only then, at last, after as much as 12 hours of exposure for a pool high on the beach, is the twice-daily trial over and cool, newly aerated and life-giving water floods in from the sea. When a group of prawns is introduced to a new pool, they fight. Females almost always win because they are larger than males for the good reason that a big female can accommodate more fertilised eggs in her breeding pouch, and more eggs increases the chance of survival. For males, no such argument applies, and it is better for them, in pools and shallows patrolled by the predatory cod, pollock and blennies, to be as discreet as possible. Looking down into a pool, this size difference is clear enough. Some big, confident prawns paddle contentedly around their world. They are the dominant, breeding females, the queens of this terror court. They may be winning, but because they are big, tasty and fat, they are eaten by their enemies more often than the males, and so in any population there is always a higher proportion of males than females. In a well-developed pool you can see it. Beside the relatively rare and handsome queens, often tucked into the best hiding places, little male courtiers flit to and fro, shadows, looking for shadows. For all this inherent antagonism and rivalry, the pool is not a place of anarchic violence. The very opposite. A certain orderly calm seems to prevail between them, disturbed only when some outside presence, my own shadow, the quick single gestures of a crab, disrupts the established order, producing the panic-struck jackknife thrashing of the escaping bodies. Only when they first meet can there be something of a face-off. Both prawns approach each other with their long, whiskery antennae, held aloft and out of the way, risking no damage to them. In front, they project aggression with a pair of their walking legs, protruding forwards like double spears, ready to encounter the enemy. This is a war face. Actual fighting is rare. Somehow the signals are read, and the likely loser usually retreats in front of the likely winner. But even this virtual confrontation is relatively uncommon. They seem to know how to cohabit without hate or fear. Why this calm? In 1999, a group of scientists at the University of Graz in Austria, led by the neuroscientist Robert Huber from Bowling Green State University in Ohio, conducted an experiment with some relatives of the prawns, the crayfish, Astacus astacus. Huber and his colleagues wanted to measure what happened to the relationships between a set of potentially fierce and mutually destructive animals when first introduced to each other in a closed space, the aquarium equivalent of a pool. The crayfish were between 12 and 18 months old, and for 8 weeks were kept in perfectly comfortable mutual isolation, fed every second day with fish food and live mealworms. Small plastic numbers were glued to their backs so that they could be identified. An aquarium was built, 3 feet long and 2 feet across, with water pumped continuously through it at a depth of about 4 inches. Every day at 9 o'clock in the morning, 5 successive groups of 4 crayfish each were put in this observation pool to see how they would behave. The situation was not unlike the conditions in which crayfish can be found in nature, where they often live together like this in small pools. The crayfish fought, and over 5 days Huber and his colleagues observed 2,452 antagonistic encounters. As the interaction progressed, maximum intensity was noted according to the following criteria. 0, no fighting. Neither animal attacked its opponent, or one animal consistently retreated from the advances of the other. 1. Threat postures. Both animals contested the interaction using threat displays or ritualized fighting without resorting to the use of their claws. 2. Claw lock. Both animals contested the encounter, and at least one animal used its claws to grab the opponent. 3. Strike and rip. Both animals contested the encounter, and at least one animal made unrestrained use of the claws in an attempt to rip or tear off appendages. The fight ended when an animal turned or walked away from its opponent, increasing the distance between them to more than one body length. At first, the fighting was brutal and unconstrained, the crayfish never hesitating to engage in combat, struggling with each other for a long time, and often at frenzied pitch in strike and rip mode. But as the encounters went on, a pattern emerged. Any crayfish that had recently won a fight became less likely to retreat in the next. Winners thought they could win again. After they had won several times and knew they were strong, they became increasingly likely to escalate to higher intensities early in the encounter. Dominant players knew they could brutalize their opponents with little risk. Victory suggested victory, and defeat, defeat. Winning enhanced further success, and losing drove individuals further and further down the social hierarchy. Slowly and steadily, this expectation of victory and loss began to shape the world of the aquarium, so that towards the end of the experiment, it grew increasingly calm. Every crayfish started to learn its place. It came to understand, from experience, which of its companions it could dominate and which would dominate it in turn. Although no one has yet done this experiment with the prawns, the neural structure of the crayfish is similar to theirs, and it is more likely than not that what seems to be the perfect calm of prawn life in the pool is, in reality, a version of rigidified terror. Unlike crayfish, Palaemon elegans don't often have physical fights, but threaten each other with close-up, face-to-face encounters, from which one blinks first and the other is left in command of the field. It means that individuals are less likely to get hurt and perhaps establishes a genetic benefit for the population, as the biggest and most powerful female prawns have access to the best food resources and the best hiding places. But there are prawns and prawns. Daniel Maskery of the University of Liverpool has recently conducted a pair of experiments with some Palaemon elegans he caught in rock pools next to Gillingvays Beach on the southern edge of Falmouth in Cornwall. In small populations, like the four groups of 40 prawns Maskery and his colleagues collected, there turns out to be an entirely predictable variation in their personality. First, Maskery put prawns into a tank which had a shelter at one end, marked with each animal individually, and recorded which prawns spent most time in the shelter and which liked to go out adventuring. He then put the same group of prawns in a tank into which he lowered, as a tasty morsel, a fully defrosted 5-gram cube of brine shrimp, and recorded which prawns were able to dominate the food resource and which came further down the pecking order. Maskery was able to show that what looked like shyness in a prawn and a timid desire to remain within the shelter was in fact a sign of dominance, since it was the apparently shy prawns that consistently monopolised the cube of brine shrimp. Those which, just as consistently, had been apparently bold, going off exploring the experimental pool out into parts of their world which might have concealed extra sources of food, but were also likely to be filled with unseen danger, did not get such good access to the brine shrimp. Bold prawns, which might have been thought of as the Walter Raleighs and Francis Drakes of their world, were in fact the victims of dominance, forced to go exploring by the tough and exclusive behaviour of their more powerful shelter-dwelling stay-at-home and food-dominating cohabitants. All the prawns Maskery chose to use were of the same size, and so there was no question of big prawns dominating the others. This was a question of character. Some were tough, home-dominating winners, others were slightly diminished survivors on the edge of society. There may be a beneficial effect of this on the population as a whole. If a group of prawns has both the resource-controlling power brokers and foolhardy-slash-courageous seekers of new horizons, the population as a whole has some elasticity and resilience built into it, a flexible response on which the next generations might have to rely if there are storms to be outlasted and changes to be weathered. Maskery called his paper "Who Dares Doesn't Always Win," but he could have called it "Conservatives Need Adventurers in a Crisis." We speculate that alternative strategies for acquiring limited resources, Dr. Maskery concluded soberly, might thereby contribute to the maintenance of personality variation observed in wild populations. Natural selection is at work in the pool, sifting multiple traits from one two-year generation to the next, creating hierarchies and allocating roles. Some prawns can benefit from a position low in one of those hierarchies. Others have the skills to become the dominant queens, monopolising the best of shelters and the food supply. It is not absurd to say that the prawns had organised themselves into little, self-perpetuating, territory-defending and resource-maximising clans. Survival is not a given. The chief dominates his or her immediate followers, who dominate those below them, and who dominate those below them in turn. Like chiefs in their defended castles, the big and powerful females in their shelters, where they guard the next generation in their brood pouches, can be seen to hold the stored capital of the little clan on which their shared future relies. At the other end of society, the poorest and weakest, for whom dominance is no more than a distant dream, are the creatures that can be cleared and evicted at will from any shelter they might claim as their own. A buried female soon appears in the centre of my pool, steadily occupying the space between two fronds of channel rack, while the others, presumably the males, continue to scud around the margins. Do these creatures have personalities? Constant behaviours can be detected in different prawns. The powerful are slow and stable. Bravado is evidence of impotence. But the idea of a personality goes beyond that. Personality requires intention and decision-making, a mind at work beyond purely instinctive or inbuilt reactions. Otherwise, a computer might be said to have a personality, helpful, neat-minded, responsive, or a stone, solid, slow, and uncooperative. Is it possible to say that a prawn, or its larger and more easily examined relative, the crayfish, ever actually decides to do something? Many experiments with these crustacea have shown that they have two different, if connected, nervous systems, one for ordinary life and one for crises. With the first, they seem to make decisions, to paddle to and fro, to go adventuring, to have a face-off with a rival. With the second, it looks as if the body, the neurons and the muscles they drive, is making decisions without the animal itself being engaged in the process. But there the language breaks down. In what way is the prawn not the body of the prawn? How can a prawn's body make decisions in which the prawn is not involved? Or does the prawn exist, inevitably you want to ask, do I exist, on two levels, one involving merely the body and the other the prawn's vivid vital self? Giant nerve fibres are gathered in a fat cord that runs along the undersurface of both crayfish and prawn, bundled together like cabling in a duct. One set transmitting information from the front of the animal, its rostrum and antennae, the other from the sensitive hairs on the abdomen and all over the shell of the tail. Other smaller nerves, the non-giants, are gathered alongside them, controlling the ordinary functions of life. If you take a big prawn, remove the shell and very carefully cut down into it from above, pinning back the muscle on each side, it is perfectly possible to find that nerve cord running down the length of the body from the little cluster of ganglia in the head, branching and then recombining around the esophagus and reaching all the way to the tail. With very careful picking apart, you can also find the little side branches that deliver information to the muscles. The giant nerves are so thick in relation to the size of the body because a prawn in crisis needs huge bandwidth. If its sense organs have detected a threat, that information must be communicated with lightning speed to the muscles of the tail that will jackknife it away from danger. And the response is dazzlingly fast. From 5 to 15 thousandths of a second, elapsing between the stimulus being given and the big abdominal muscles contracting into the escape flex. It is a flash of electric impulse surging through the connecting axons between the nerve cells, with very little delay at the synapses, what is, in effect, an electric hotline from sensors to escape muscle. Over many years and with degrees of invasive maltreatment, scientists have investigated in great detail the way in which these giant fibres work. They are not stimulated by anything, however brutal, that happens slowly, not, as one paper expressed it, by gradual pinching, even to the point of breaking sternal ribs, by prodding, even to the point of piercing the ventral cuticle, by making extensive incisions of the belly, or by mashing, cutting, or pulling off appendages. At first, it was thought that only an intense stimulus would trigger the giant fibres into the tail thrash response. But in 1972, Jeffrey Wine and Franklin Krasny of the University of California implanted electrodes into freely swimming crayfish, and discovered, by measuring the currents in the giant fibres, that intensity is not as important as suddenness. Very light taps are often effective, and since the giant nerves occasionally fire just prior to actual contact, it may be that even the pressure waves in advance of a rapidly approaching object can be an adequate stimulus. In free animals, the lightest touch of an antenna or antennule may elicit giant nerve responses. That finding confirms everything you might have guessed from looking down into the prawn pool. the first nerve system continues to govern everyday life. Make no sudden movement and cast no sudden shadow, and the prawns will coast about their world, framed by the hierarchy they have established between themselves. But stand up suddenly, or even move an arm that throws a shadow on the water, and the jump reflex kicks in. Experiments have shown that the sudden escape surge does not originate in the cluster of ganglions in its head, the central processing unit of the prawn, what non-scientists might call its brain, but is communicated directly from the animal's senses to the muscles in the tail, bypassing any thinking mechanism. The jackknife escape is involuntary, the equivalent of our jumping away from a flame before we know that it is hot or that it is burning us. By contrast, everyday movements in prawns originates in the brain. These non-giant reactions are essentially voluntary in nature. Animals very much appear to choose their own moments to respond. That process of choosing how to behave is up to 10 times slower than the millisecond thrash of the giant nerve response. This latency, or tendency to delay, is significant. We believe, Professors Wine and Krasny wrote, that the longer latency of these reactions provides time for the animal to adjust his response to the situation. That difference is apparent in the rock pool. A certain slow deliberation in the trawling prawn, a pausing to consider, sometimes turning this way, sometimes that, thinking what to do next, evaluating the state of play. These movements, as Jen Heberholtz and Gregory Marquardt from the University of Maryland have written recently, should be considered, in a way, voluntary, because the animal chooses to activate certain patterns of flexor muscle groups. Heberholtz and Marquardt put scare quotes around both voluntary and chooses, because the idea that a crustacean has a will is still thought questionable. It seems to me, anyway, that the implications are clear. Like us, the crustacean has non-conscious escape reactions alongside a whole set of behaviours that are entirely conscious. The crayfish, or prawn, usually considers its next move, at least until danger threatens, and only then is all thought banished. These are two ways of being, structured at the level of the neuron and not entirely unlike ours. In peace, there's nothing so becomes a prawn as modest stillness and humility, but when the blast of war blows in his ears, he changes radically, jetting away from danger faster than his enemy can get him. We and the prawns are alike, both careful, thinking and resource-maximizing, and sudden, instinctive and threat-reacting. I look at the prawns in this pool I have made, and I am looking at an aspect of myself. One thing these crustacea don't do, it has been long thought, is to plan ahead, nor practice any vigilance, looking out for enemies that might hurt them. They have been said to rely entirely on the nerve burst of reflex response when a sudden threat appears. It was long assumed that it was a fixed response to fixed signals, so that, as Heberholtz and Marquardt have said, the decision to escape is made at individual decision-making neurons. If the predatory signal is sufficient to activate them, escape will inevitably follow. No mind was involved. The sensors and nerves and the muscles to which they are connected controlled the behaviour. Recent research has changed all that. Suddenness may be what a prawn dislikes most, but the tail flip is not always the response to it. Exposed to the sudden arrival of underwater noise from boat engines in a busy harbour, prawns do show the clearest signs of distress. If they are killed and dissected afterwards, the brain and blood contain high levels of stress hormones. But when repeated experimentally, it was found that the prawns did not try to escape as the noise went over, but went stock still, freezing in situ. Heberholtz and Marquardt investigated this conundrum. If the jackknife response was purely instinctive, why did the crayfish not make it whenever they were threatened? Was mind somehow involved in the choice between freezing and flipping away? They put some crayfish in an artificial stream and exposed them to fast-moving shadows, which, critically, came from the same direction as the smell of food. In response, the crayfish did one of two things, either flipping away from both food and shadow, or freezing and remaining motionless until the threat had passed. How did they choose? Freeze or flight? There were certainly character differences. Some crayfish were habitual freezers, some habitual flippers, whatever the circumstances around them. More interestingly, though, as Herberholtz and others had found in previous experiments, the speed at which the shadow approached the crayfish tended to govern the response. Shadows moving at 1 meter a second summoned more tail flips than freezings. As speed increased to over 2 meters and then to 4 meters a second, crayfish tended to freeze in front of the threat. The water flowing past the crayfish was full of the smell of food. 1 gram of crushed medium-sized shrimp pellets, Ocean Nutrition Formula One Aquapets Americas. The crustaceans had to decide which was the better option, to run and probably abandon the chance of shrimp, or to freeze, hoping perhaps to be invisible, and as soon as the danger had passed, happily resuming their foraging. In a third experiment, it was found that very fast approaching shadows were considered inescapable, as the shadow overwhelmed them before they could generate a tail flip. It clearly made what the scientists call economic sense not to flip in those circumstances. Because it was too late to get away, a late flip would not save it, and if it flipped, in natural circumstances with very mobile food, the crayfish would lose the chance of catching its prey. So their neural systems have been selected over time to freeze when food was near and the threat was fast. The Maryland scientists found that the stronger the smell of food, the more likely the crayfish were to freeze. Crayfish calculate the costs and benefits of different behavioural options, and they carefully weigh predation risk against expected reward, eventually selecting the most valuable behavioural choice. This makes the picture complicated. It seems as if the power to choose is an aspect not only of the everyday coasting around the pool, but is there within the lightning-fast reactions that might lead to a tail flip. In times approaching 600ths of a second, the crustaceans make the decision to flip or freeze. The usual neural pathways used for poking around the pool are not in play. The flip is activated, or not, by the giant fibres in the nerve bundle running the length of the animal's body. So the response is not, as was previously thought, entirely stereotypical. It can vary. Even at this speed, and even using the neurons in the giant fibres, the crayfish is capable of making a choice. No one understands this yet, but somehow, in response to a particular combination of terror and hunger, it can decide. But is the crayfish making the decision, or its body? It is an odd and repeated experience that unless you know to look for something, you are blind to it. Only after reading these papers by the Maryland biologists did I see the behaviours they had described, the low-level ordinariness of life conducted with all normality between the rocks, the jerk flipping away from my shadow, and then the freeze, the absolute stillness of the alert body as I tried coming up at them quickly, moving my hand and its shadow as fast as I could. 4 meters a second is about 9 miles an hour. And seeing how under it the tiny crustaceans paused like dancers, as if the film had been stopped, until the threat diminished and normality resumed. It was all there in front of me, the unseen genius of the prawn body and mind, revealing its layered abilities to think, evaluate, and decide. It would not be difficult to program a robot to be like this. Instructions, in everyday life, swim about the pool. If a sudden movement is detected, flip away. If too sudden, stay where you are. If the smell of food is in the water, grade your response. The stronger the smell, the less likely the flip. Here, then, is the strange philosophical question of the prawn in the pool. It has skills and habits. It behaves with the consistency of a coherent being. It can detect its surroundings and move towards places where life is better and safer. It recognizes its superiors and its place in a hierarchy. It makes choices on at least two neural levels. Is it a machine, or does it have a self? Is the prawn more like me or my phone? A prawn always floats the right way up. It arranges itself like that through little organs called statocysts that sprout from near the bottom of its short antennae. They are small round sacs, only about 1 millimetre wide, covered with a flap and filled with liquid. The floor of the statocysts is lined in little sensitive hairs, on which there is a small heap of sand grains, which are lost when the prawn molts. It gathers up a new set for its new shell. If the prawn tips to the left, the sand grains press a little harder on that side, and the prawn corrects its position until the pressure equalizes. In some pools, I have found prawns in which the statocysts are clearly not working properly, and a prawn, otherwise complete and perfect, moves through its life, tipped slightly to one side, like a boat whose ballast has shifted, or a cow with one leg shorter than the others. It is the tenderest of sights, a prawn disabled either from a genetic flaw or from damage in life, nevertheless persisting in its life purpose, somehow accommodating what has happened to it. These statocysts are shared among all the invertebrates, and have their equivalent in vertebrate animals too, from fish upwards. Is the process mechanical, or to do with being? Colin Klein and Andrew Barron, both philosophers at Macquarie University, Sydney, in discussing what they call the hard problem of consciousness, think a key element in this question is precisely the sense of being in the world, of an organism orientating itself in a set of circumstances that are clearly not part of what it is. Klein and Barron are convinced that invertebrates such as these prawns are aware of the world, including the state of the mobile body within the world, and that this awareness feels a certain way to the organism that has it. Not only does the tipped prawn know that it is out of balance, Klein and Barron think that its need or desire to be in balance gives it a certain feeling, a feeling bound up with its existence as a prawn. That sense of getting itself right in the world is virtually indistinguishable from the feeling of selfhood. It exists, it knows that it exists, and it knows that it should exist in a certain way. The prawn has no pilot. It is itself. It is making its own choices. It has its own feelings. It provides its own fuel. It generates its own progeny. Does all of that imply it is not a machine? Charles Darwin looked carefully into the ways fear, anger, and affection were emotional experiences that seemed common to the animals we know well, and decided it was obvious that non-human animals had feelings. The lower animals, like man, he wrote in The Descent of Man and Selection in relation to sex, manifestly feel pleasure and pain, happiness and misery. The fact that the lower animals are excited by the same emotions as ourselves is so well established that it will not be necessary to weary the reader by many details. Can invertebrates have emotions? The European Union's animal health and welfare scientists concluded in 2005 that the largest of decapod crustaceans, a term which includes prawns, are complex in behaviour and appear to have some degree of awareness. They have a pain system and considerable learning ability, and so all decapods should receive protection. Other scientists fought that idea, and the crustaceans were not protected under EU animal welfare legislation. Almost alone, Switzerland has included lobsters and crayfish in their laws for the humane treatment of animals. The difficult question was whether the crustaceans were capable of feeling pain. Many attempts have been made to see if they do, electric shocks to mantis shrimps, ghost crabs, crayfish, hermit crabs and green crabs, acid on the antennae of prawns and crayfish, formaldehyde, ink, quinine and caffeine painted on green crabs, peppers, wasabi, a soldering iron at 54 degrees Celsius and dry ice at minus 78.5 degrees Celsius, all applied to the most sensitive parts of crayfish. The animals often reacted to these treatments, and clearly they have means of perceiving something that is harmful to them, the capacity known as nociception. But do they experience that sensation as pain? The question is bound up with the problem of consciousness, because pain is an emotional response to physical hurt. It is the difference between our sudden and unconscious pulling a hand away from a hot plate, nociception, and a second later feeling something, pain, which needs rubbing and looking after. Nociception does not need a mind. It can work like a smoke alarm. Pain requires the kind of consciousness in crustaceans that has been suggested by Colin Klein and Andrew Barron, and is in some ways analogous to ours. But do they have it? There are many who deny it. Dr. Ben Diggles, a Queensland aquaculture and fisheries consultant, makes the point that electric shocks used by some research groups to generate behavioural changes in crabs could represent an irritation, stimulus, unpleasant sensation, buzz, itch or tingle if applied to human skin under similar circumstances. Dr. Diggles asks us to consider that the ways in which other invertebrates are so radically unlike us, insects eating their own innards and continuing feeding while being eaten, mean that any extension of the idea of pain to them would be absurd. It may be that the running of a big brain is an expensive option for an animal, and invertebrates are under heavy selective pressure to reduce the cost and size of their brains. Brainlessness and painlessness may, on the level of a population as a whole, be an effective choice in a brutally competitive world. This may seem depressing. The prawns I have come to be so fond of in my pool may be irredeemably distant, way down the far end of evolution's long road, as foreign to me as anything I might ever encounter as an animal. But all is far from lost. Some subtle and recent experiments with freshwater crayfish, made by Pascal Fossa, a young professor at the University of Bordeaux, have transformed the discussion. Fossa and his colleagues fish some Procamborus clarkii out of the beautiful marshes in the Marais de Bruges, just north of Bordeaux. Procamborus is a fearsome-looking creature, an American invasive, dark red and formidably armoured, known to a million diners in the southern United States as the Louisiana crawfish or mudbug. Crayfish and prawns are naturally exploratory. They will hide in dark, sheltered places when threatened, but will also go looking around their marshes and pools by day and night. Fossa wanted to know if these crayfish could ever feel anxious, not during fearful moments or when calm, but after they had been exposed to stress. Would they adapt their behaviour because of what they remembered? Modelling his experiment on previous trials with rats and mice, he built a very simple underwater maze in the shape of a cross, where two arms were kept dark and two brightly lit. The aim was to put a crayfish at the central crossing and make it choose between its innate curiosity for new places and its dislike of anywhere that was overbright and threatening, with nowhere to hide. Fossa kept all the crayfish for 3 weeks in a state of well-fed calm and then divided them into three groups. One he exposed to a set of mild electric shocks, to which they responded with tail thrashing, and one group he left unmolested. The third he exposed to the electricity and then gave them an injection of benzodiazepine, a powerful anxiety-reducing drug. When unstressed crayfish were placed in the crossing, they set off to explore the whole maze, including the bright white arms. Those that had been given the electric shocks stayed only in the dark arms, and if they wandered into the beginning of the bright arms, paused, considered, and rapidly left them. The stressed crayfish that were later injected with the anxiety-reducing drug behaved in ways indistinguishable from the unstressed animals. It was an astonishing discovery. For the first time in a crustacean, Fossa had witnessed the kind of anxious behaviour only previously seen in vertebrates. Anxiety is distinct from fear, which is a response to present danger and generates the instant behaviours, escape, freeze or aggression. Anxiety is more subtle than that, because it occurs when the danger is either not there, or at least not known to be there. It is what Fossa calls an anticipatory fear, which allows the animal to deal with danger more easily when it comes. Fossa's discovery introduces a complexity into the character of the crustacean, which implies a vivid and layered self. To behave like this, it must have a memory of past fearful events, be capable of a carefulness which involves projecting its existence into the future. If an animal can be anxious, it must know about the passage of time. An anxious prawn or crayfish has both a past and a future. In that sense, Fossa revealed that a crayfish had an imagination, a mind in which possibility could take its place alongside actuality, and in which decisions could be made not in the face of what it saw or smelt or otherwise perceived, but what it thought or dreamed or feared might be there. In this context, Fossa wrote in Science, the crayfish represents a new model that might provide insights into the mechanisms underlying anxiety that have been conserved during evolution. Our results also emphasize the ability of an invertebrate to exhibit a state that is similar to a mammalian emotion, but which likely arose early during the evolution of metazoans. A metazoan is the word a professor of biology will use to mean anything that has lived since the great extinctions at the end of the Permian 252 million years ago. With the formal modesty usual in scientific papers, Fossa was making the great and beautiful claim that virtually all animal life on Earth knows what it feels like to be alive.